Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And welcome to Comedy Album Book Club. We're still getting used to not having Jason around, and this month we're doing another interview. This time we have an interview with Toronto comedian Joe Vu. Joe Vu has performed at the Winnipeg Comedy Festival, appeared on CBC's Debaters, and taken the stage at Just for Laughs. I met Joe while he was recording another podcast, Tracy Hamilton's Love is Everywhere, which I highly recommend. Joe and I got to talking about the mechanics of comedy, and I knew I wanted to have him on the show. As well as performing, Joe has done several videos on YouTube about the process and industry of comedy, and has released his own album, First Generation Comedian, which we touch on during the conversation. Stay safe, everyone, and enjoy our conversation. Joe Vu, thank you for joining us at Comedy Album Book Club.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm still getting used to being the main host, so I'm still using that like royal us, so yeah. Forgive me. But yeah, so I met you not too long ago. You recorded an episode of Tracy Hamilton's Love is Everywhere.
Yeah, that was really good.
Yeah, and I actually, that was the first place I saw you perform live, was at one of her shows.
Did we talk about this? Did you say you saw me?
No. It's sort of like in the moment. But yeah, I had seen you perform there. And I think I'd seen your Winnipeg comedy set.
Yeah.
On either YouTube or CBC. I can't remember. Nice. But so I had seen you perform a couple of times live and in recording. So it's terrific to have a chance to chat with you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I love talking about comedy.
Yeah, it's one of those things that, you know, I mean, the comedy album book club is, we do a lot of old comedy albums and stuff, which makes it a little bit like kind of almost like forensics like in a way, because like some stuff, like we did an evening with Mike Nichols and Elaine May, was our first album, and that stands up no problem.
Yeah,
but we did the Carnegie Hall album for Lenny Bruce, and I mean, as much as he's influenced comedy, that does not hold up.
Yeah,
but once you start evaluating it within context, it's like, oh, okay, this is what he's doing. So it's like, it's the math and science of comedy that makes it interesting.
Right. So when you say it doesn't hold up, do you mean like it's not funny, or do you mean like the societal norms and like the...
A bit of column A and column B. It's because like just the way we've communicated has changed. We've moved, because with him, he was definitely like an ally to the gay community before there was a gay community.
Yeah.
He was an ally to people of color. He was an ally to sex workers because like he grew up in a burlesque house kind of thing. So he was definitely an ally, but the language he used...
Oh, okay.
Just as like in our modern palette, was like, ooh, no.
Yeah.
It's like watching Archie Bunker and All in the Family, where it's like, oh, Archie's a monster. And it's like, yes, that's the point. And with Lenny Bruce, he was using his intellect to try to like just flip the script for a lot of people, because he was very,
he mixed idiom and intellectualism, like local idioms and intellectualism, in a way that's like, oh, keeps you off balance.
Yeah.
But as a modern listener, it's like, oh, this just doesn't click. Kind of thing.
Yeah.
So and there's a lot of stuff was like that. I mean, it's there's quite a few albums where it's just, oh, you gotta like put your mind in the right context, and then it's like, okay, this makes sense. I mean, another one we did was the Smothers Brothers. I can't remember the entire title, but there's their Purple Onion. So there's a club in San Francisco which is a folk club primarily, but a lot of comedians performed there. Like Robin Williams was one of the people who performed there, and it's like their comedy is very much of that 1960s folk era, where comedy and folk and just the underground music scene were sort of all the same scene for that like decade or half decade, where it was all sort of mixing together. And outside of that context, it's like, why are they singing basically a straight folk song on this comedy album?
That's kind of strange. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so it's just dissecting that context, and that comes back to that science. Like a joke now, it in 20 years, is it going to be funny? I don't know. Like,
yeah,
some might be, some probably won't be, and that's what we live talking about here.
Cool. Kind of. Yeah.
So when I reached out to you, instead of an album, you'd mentioned Blake Snyder's Save the Cat. So how did that influence your comedy?
Yeah, well, did you get a chance to look at
it? Yeah.
So I don't know. I like to mix a lot of my different background into stand-up comedy and film writing and script writing. I feel like it has a natural fit once you start doing longer sets.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you have a short set, you can do whatever. But when you have a longer one, I feel like you have to start telling a story.
Yeah.
And if you're telling a story, you should really look to screenwriting. Mm-hmm. So Save the Cat, for the listeners who haven't read it. The premise of Saving the Cat is that if you introduce a character at the beginning of the movie, if you get them to do something nice that endears the audience, they'll empathize with that person and they'll like them and be along for the ride. And so Save the Cat could be like literally have your character save a cat.
Mm-hmm.
Amongst other things. So I applied that to my stand-up, where it's like, you ever notice when you're telling jokes to friends, it's so much easier? It's because they are already endeared to you.
Yeah.
Right? Amongst other reasons, like you could do inside jokes and stuff like that because you have a history. But they like you a lot. People who like you will laugh at your jokes more and like are easier on you. So if you can introduce them to the Save the Cat idea, then the rest of your set's gonna be so much easier. So the way I did that was like, you know, you could do it by self-deprecating things, or you could tell a story where you did an action that would get them to endear you to you.
Yeah,
you know, tell a story, you saved the cat or something like that. Yeah. You know,
in your album First Generation Comedian, there's a moment in Ottawa Hot, the tail end, where there's like an awe from the audience, like it's like, oh, this audience is clearly on your side.
Yeah.
And it feels like, you know, that early work that you put in at the beginning with the self-deprecatory kind of stuff is like where you build that bond, that if you just launch straight into that, it wouldn't have been there.
Totally. My whole album is structured specifically, you know, a certain way, like self-deprecating at the beginning, showing like my weaknesses, how I need to improve as a person, and then by the end showing some success, showing some character growth, just like in the movie.
And it is like, it's interesting because like you've got three different periods in there, like of your comedy work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, if you really listen to it, it's like, oh, I can hear the difference, but the way you've woven them together, it does feel like a story. It feels like a natural progression.
Thank you.
It's from there. Yeah. So it's really.
Yeah, it was all planned out to be that way.
Excellent. Now you're working on a new album, right?
Yeah. Well, once you have this one out, you kind of start working on a new one, but it's hard because it's like this one took like almost 8 years to make, right? And then now I'm going and doing sets where I don't have solid jokes anymore, and you start doubting your writing ability. Will I ever write a funny joke as I did before? And it's hard. So then you just basically, to help your ego a little bit, you mix in some old stuff with your new stuff, so it's not all terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. As you're trying to find good new stuff. Yeah.
For like balance out that. So you were a journalist and a copywriter before you got into comedy. How does that impact your writing?
Well, I think copywriting helped me the most. I think copywriting is basically like writing one-liners.
Mm-hmm.
Like kind of like Mitch Hedberg would be like a great copywriter. Maybe he was, I don't know. But but yeah, just like set up punchline. And it helped me be very, I don't know, what's the word where you're choosing your words carefully and not a lot of words.
Just being like precise with your language.
It's another word I'm trying to think for it, but I can't think of it right now. But yeah. So yeah, just keeping my word count down.
Yeah.
So I like in copywriting and in joke writing, I'll have a thing where I'll look over my joke and I'll imaginary pay myself $20 for every word I can take out.
Cool.
And then you end up taking out a lot of words and then you're like, I didn't actually really need those words in there. So just finding the shortest way to say things to people.
That's something I've been struggling with. I started doing stand-up and just like open mics and the Second City courses. And like, we'll have, okay, you're given 5 minutes and the rule of thumb is, you know, 100 words per minute is about where it says it. And I'm like, I can never get it down to 500 words. I struggle so hard. And it's like, okay, am I wed to a concept or is it, or am I wed to certain words? And that's my battle. And it's actually way better than it used to be. Like when I was writing sketches, I'd write like 9-page treatments on a sketch that should be like 3 pages.
I was going to say, do you come from improv or sketch background? Because I find like, especially improvisers, the word count is a lot higher than if you only did stand up.
Yeah, I started with, because we started this podcast about a little over 2 years ago. And Jason, who was the old host, is an actor and formerly and he still does sketch comedy and a bit of stand up from time to time, but primarily an actor and sketch comedian. And he'd have all these we'd have all these guests who are local comedians or comedy writers and stuff. And I'm like the guy who works in insurance in the room. So I'm like, I love comedy, but I'm like, I'm not gone up there. And I just felt
but you bring a different perspective then.
So my thing was like, I want to be able to roll with these guys, like roll with the punches when they get riffing. So I started taking some improv and that, and I'm now doing level 2 at Second City, and next semester I'm doing some writing,
like level B, right?
Where basically you're just getting up every night with 5 more minutes and I'm looking forward to that being done, if only because I can then stop generating new content every week and start like just refining stuff and spend some time
writing, as in stand-up comedy.
So
you're taking an improv class and a
I took improv class. I've did A through E. For those who don't know, that's the full basic course range at Second City. Then stand-up 1 and stand-up 2.
Oh, okay.
And next semester I'm just taking writing, which is going to be sketch.
Nice.
I feel the most comfortable in stand-up. I mean, that's where I was introduced to comedy. That's where it came from. Like, my earliest memories were like of comedy, or like listening to my dad's, you know, Carlin and Cosby and all these records in the 60s and 70s that he was listening to them into like the late 70s and early 80s. And that's just where that love came from. I just find myself most comfortable in that, because like I love improv, because that entire like team collaborative feeling is nice. Like and generally, like high school improv sucked because everybody's like, I gotta get the laugh. But in reality, grown up improv, as it should be, people are there just to help one another to get to that point where they want to be happy. Yeah. And sketch is fun because you can really drill down on stuff. You can get an idea and like really explore the bizarreness of that idea.
Yeah.
But like with improv, you're kind of beholden to the group, and sketch, you can't really be you're in the moment, but you have to stick to the lines.
Yeah.
Whereas stand up, I'm able to like just, I can chart my own course.
It's kind of like an in between the two then of improv and sketch.
Yeah, it's right? Like the best of both worlds.
Yeah, it's like you plan some stuff, but if you want to go off course, you're allowed to also.
Yeah, and like sometimes you'll just be in the moment and a tag comes to you like right there and you can try it out. And if it gets a laugh, it gets a laugh. If not, you're like, oh, okay, don't do that again. Or wait for a different room and see if it works there.
I think there's something that happens to our brains while we're on stage and we get a vibe for the audience that we can think of this tag that we would never think of just sitting at home, you know? And, and I find that that also carries with me a little bit as I walk off stage. Like, I could still feel the things that worked with this audience and what didn't work. And, like, I'll think of tags off the stage, but immediately within the hour it's almost as if I'm on the stage saying those tags too, and I think of my best stuff while I'm on the stage or like within an hour of performing.
It's like this residual energy
of the audience kind of hangs around.
I've only been able to perform the Second City classes. I don't really count them as a real audience. I mean, they're lovely family and friends who I appreciate laughing at my jokes, but they're a little generous. So I only have the two real extremes. I did stand up before a paying audience last week, but it's still similar to that. Mm-hmm. It was the sketch and improv troupe let us.
Yeah.
Those of us who do stand up do a set. So we had like three there. And I was sort of the opening act at a Valentine's Day show and did a set that was basically the story of how I met or how I started dating and eventually proposed to my wife.
Oh, nice.
And it's just like, you're very generous.
Well, those shows, you're getting a lot of different bumps, right? You're getting the, like, friends and family, because, like I said, they know you.
Yeah.
Right? They want you to do well. And then also, probably from those classes, they know you're new to it. So you're getting the new bump. And then you're also getting, like, just the general Second City niceness bump.
Yes. Yeah. And but then the other extreme is I've done a couple of open mics in the city and I want to do more.
Yeah, those are the extremes.
It's the other, the entire opposite extreme where it's like, if you get a, from anybody other than your classmates and like you're pretty lucky. And like both night, well, one night was great. And that was as at another bar with Mark Hallworth.
Mark brings good energy.
So. Yeah, he's just such a wonderful human being.
Very positive. So it leaks to the show. Right?
Yeah. So that was a good night. And still, even then, like, there's weirdness because of it being an open mic. You get the weird people in. And I tried going to a couple of other shows. Well, I did one other night at a place that I won't name.
Yeah.
And a guy just fucking melted down. Yeah. He's just totally... That's... But not like a... Oh, I'm losing my set I'm throwing chairs and swinging the mic stand around and hitting things. And then when he gets off, because he obeys the light, oddly enough, starts throwing beer.
Probably conditioning or something.
Yeah.
The light comes
my Pavlovian response, time to get off. He starts throwing beer cans at the hosts.
That's nuts.
And it's like, I mean, I don't know if that's reflective of the general tone of that night. But it was like, oh, this is very off-putting.
That sounds rare for any open mic to me. So
that's
not the norm.
But then the other night that I went to where the list filled up within minutes. So I didn't get on. It was just like the first half of the set was very disturbing men making very disturbing jokes that are like, are you trying to be the Joker right now? Because this is just...
Oh, man.
Ugh.
Yeah, you start to get to know who's going to joke like that. And then if you see a lot of those people at the mic, you're like, I hope I get to go early so I can go before them and not kill the vibe, like not have an audience left that's already dead because like all the crazy material.
Yeah. And the wild thing for me, too, though, is in both cases, like after a certain point, it was people who I know do it professionally, working new material, being super funny. So it's like, once you get past that hump, wherever it is in the list, and probably towards the middle, because those guys are all there super early waiting to sign up.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, here's the people who are actually doing this not because they can't afford therapy and actually are like workshopping a joke or a bit kind of thing. And it's like a totally different experience. So it's I'm I'm enjoying the experience, but it's just it's hard to
figure out. You're just going from one extreme to the other. You need to like trudge through enough open mics that you get to the point where you're booked on some shows.
Yeah.
And that's the middle ground.
Yes.
Right? And that's what you want to be doing, just like booked shows that have audience members that isn't an open mic.
Yeah. Now, I've been watching your video series, laying out a lot of the fundamentals. And you talk about some great stuff like structure and the nature of a room and the inspirations that you've had. Like, what inspired you to make that video series?
I have two. So there's like the life of a stand-up and then like explaining the joke.
I've been watching both.
Oh, both of them?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, to be honest, I was trying to make some YouTube money. That was like the beginning of it. But I also like didn't want to do anything unless I'm having fun doing it. Mm-hmm. And I did have a lot of fun doing it. And I learned a lot about editing. But like I also said before to you, I just love talking about comedy, like the science of it and trying to figure out why things work. Because I've always been a planner, and that's why I wasn't great with improv, because I was in my head too much.
Yeah.
But stand-up, you can be in your head before you get on stage. Yeah. Being in your head on stage is not great, but like I like to kind of minimize the number of times I bomb, whatever way it can be. So like trying to figure out the science of a joke helps them.
Yeah. Now, talking about that science, I mean, so there's sort of two factors. There's the science of the room and the science of the joke. For people who are maybe not as familiar, why don't we start with the joke? Because there's like trying to find the pace, like that magic pace of like, okay, here's where I need to hit the beats.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what goes into that? Is there like a method that you use, or is it just like natural at this point?
You know, like when I write a joke, I try not to think about any of the science stuff, because there's too many things and too many rules to think about, and then you'll just not be able to write anything at all.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just write the joke out, and then afterwards, after the joke is done, then you go back to it and you try to plus it up by making sure, you know, you leave enough pauses before punchlines. There's varying like sentences to keep things interesting. Where is this? What kind of joke is this? Is this going to be an opening joke? Is this going to be later in your set? Like, there's so many factors that you start to think of after you write the joke, and that's my process, I guess.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And now, what about like, for example, like I performed at like the SoCap on the second floor, which is like a weird space because it's high ceilings, but it's still kind of dark and still kind of intimate because it's kind of narrow. So people are still cramped in, versus something like, you know, the two rooms at Comedy Bar, where like the cabaret room, which is very tight, but the ceilings are, I still feel a bit higher there than in the main room, where it feels like that really low ceiling kind of experience. And then at like open mics where it's just like giant freaking rooms with like no aesthetic or thought to what would make it a good space.
There's so many things to what jokes will work where. So like you're talking about the size of the room, right? Like if you're in a small intimate space versus if you're doing like, not that any of us would do it, like a stadium or something, or a concert hall. Generally you would have like higher energy and be more big, right? Because if you're just this quiet, tiny little person in this big stadium, it's not going to translate well.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, like if I was taping an album, I wouldn't want to do like some huge concert hall or something, or something, a big space or high ceilings. Like we could just even narrow it down to like high ceilings or not. I'd want to do it in a tight space because my comedy works better in a smaller room with a tight group of people.
Did you watch My Name is Dolomite on Netflix?
No,
The Eddie Murphy. It's really good. And one thing I noticed about that, because it's a real guy who basically worked his way up as a stand-up.
Yeah.
And then got into like these sort of very silly Shaft-like movies. But like he found this character after sort of doing very typical stuff, but he found this character that was unique, a unique voice that he really brought to life. But his first album he recorded in his like living room. So he just, but he got like 30 people in and was serving them booze, and it's this really tight space, and there's like him right in front of his bed with a jazz band gathered around him playing in the background. And is that, and that is that, is that like, it's a contagiousness of laughs. It's like he knew that he needed people to be all together.
Yeah.
And in that room. And it's like, you know, when you're sitting next to somebody who's laughing, it makes you more inclined to laugh.
Yeah.
Like, because sometimes it'll be just like, oh, that's funny. But if somebody's going, ha, 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 you're going to join in.
That's the whole idea of like laugh tracks.
Yeah.
Right. The science behind why it worked before, until people are too savvy now and can pick up on it and think it's cheap.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, but laughter, yeah, begets laughter.
And it's like that. I do a lot of the JFL 42 stuff, or at least I have for a while. I'm sort of taking a bit of a break right now.
Yeah.
Or last year I did. And they moved back to the, I can't remember the name of the theater, but on the CNE grounds. Like the Queen, I don't know, some royal name. And it's that, that space is just a nightmare. Yeah. When it comes to comedy, because I've seen a whole bunch of really funny people there, and it's like, it's flat,
just doesn't work.
High ceiling. Yeah. Like even in the audience, you can't hear the other people laughing.
Oh, because that's no good.
It's just like so spread out, and the acoustics are good for hearing from the stage, but it's designed in such a way that it's sort of hushed. And I mean, that's why I prefer, like, they have a lot of shows at the Royal.
Yeah.
Which is like a movie theater, but that seems more inclined to a better show than this big theater with just sucks up the sound.
Yeah. And the size of a room also like is important for the style of comic you are. Like one of my friends likes to do like riskier jokes that are either hit or miss.
Yeah.
So like if he did a small room, that's going to be again hit or miss, cuz there's going to be only like 30 people or whatever.
Yeah.
And if he does something that's really out there, there's a chance that none of them find it funny. It's a small sample number, right? But if he's doing like a 200 seater, like at a club, like Absolute Comedy or Yuck Yucks or something, that's much better for him, because some, at least like 5 or 6 people will start to laugh at it, right? That'll be their sense of humor, and that will lighten, hearing that laugh will lighten other people, and then they have verification that he's, you know, that's an okay joke. But if there's no one laughing, then it's hard to get off the ground.
Yeah.
Right. So
is it like you need like kindling for the fire? Yeah, kind of thing.
Yeah. So with the sheer number of people, there's going to be some kindle.
Yeah. Now you've done Winnipeg, you've done festivals and shows. Like, what are like, so comparing like doing, recording a set for TV versus like getting up on a stage at a local room, like how is it, like, I guess, how's the preparation different, and what are the kinds of things that you do up on stage differently?
Okay, the preparation would be, I think the preparation wouldn't be any different for something like you hadn't done before. Like, think about your first 10 stand-up performances. You practice the hell out of it, right? Because it's a new thing. And then after a few years, you're not scared anymore because you've done it so much. But then TV is like a new level, right?
Yeah.
So then you're preparing it the same way that you'd prepared those first 10 times. You're just practicing the hell out of it again. Mm-hmm. So I think it's like every level that you reach, every newer, higher level, it's kind of like you do the same thing you did the levels before.
Cool.
What was the other half of the question?
Oh, just and like once you're up there, how does it feel different? Like, what do you do differently, or how do you handle the set differently?
Yeah, because it's a big stage. I think Winnipeg had like close to 800 people.
Wow.
And I told you that I'm a quieter comic, right?
Yeah.
So then I just have to give more energy, show more expression, move a little bit. I usually anchor myself.
Yeah.
So I want to, because you don't want to, it's all about, again, making that rapport with people, right? Because if they like you, then they'll laugh with you.
Yeah.
If I'm just looking straight ahead and not involving, like, the sides of me, my left side, my right, stage right and stage left, then I'm not going to be connecting with those people, and they're not going to find me as funny.
Yeah.
So I have to kind of like move and turn and walk around and look around, involve everyone, bring them in, have them into me as a person, so they'll root for me for when I get to the climax, or like the best parts of my jokes, that they'll be really into it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Now, you're working on a new album. Are you planning on playing with the, because like they kind of played with the format in your first one. Are you planning on trying that? It's not necessarily the same thing, but playing with format a bit at all.
I don't think the first one, the format that I played with was I tried to as close as I could. It was it was chronologically played. Mm-hmm. Like the jokes in the early in my album were like jokes that I wrote early. And then so you can kind of see my growth, not only like they could see that I was getting funnier, or like you could also see my growth as a person, depending on the types of jokes I was doing. I don't think I'm going to play with format too much, but I always like to have a theme.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm going to do some sort of roots or like Vietnam travel kind of theme, because I am planning, because I feel like good writing comes from experience. I am planning to go back and live in Vietnam for at least like 3 months.
Oh, wow.
I feel like that's going to help me like have a new perspective on things, see my roots a bit better, and like have a ton of material maybe. And so my next album would be Vietnam focused.
Yeah. You thought of maybe trying to do comedy in Vietnam?
I think I will too. There is a burgeoning scene. It's not to like Vietnamese people, that's to expats. Mm-hmm. So it'll be in English to other people who speak English well.
Yeah. I saw Mateo Lane at the Comedy Cellar.
Yeah.
Couple of years ago now.
Yeah, is before the guy with mustache, right?
Yes, yeah, and totally ripped. He's I follow him on Instagram, and it's like him and like one of the cast from Community. I can't actually look at Instagram on public transit because of the two of them, because like half the time it's like them, like one's a man, one's a woman, both of them are in various states of undress.
Yeah.
And I mean, if I had either of their bodies, I would be doing that too. Yeah. But yeah, like, so as a digression, but yeah, so I saw him perform at Comedy Bar or Comedy Cellar, and I actually did see him at Comedy Bar. He's like a freaking amazing performer, like opera singer, animator, illustrator, write sketch and stand up, and just like
very cool.
Just like true Renaissance man. And he lived in Italy and like worked as an opera singer in Italy for a while.
Just has a lot of life experience.
And
helps.
Yeah, and he did this one set. The set I saw at Comedy Bar was him performing Barbara Streisand's songs from like the 60s when she was couch surfing in the East Village.
Yeah.
And going to all of those like little clubs that were like folk comedy clubs. But anyhow, what he is like Italian, Mexican, I think Irish. I don't know. Yeah. He's like got a multi-ethnic mix. And we saw him, and he was talking to the audience, doing crowd work and talk, because it's New York, there's a good chance you've got tourists there.
Yeah.
It's like anybody from Italy. And then he just slides into Italian and starts doing jokes in Italian. Or it's like that is incredible. To be able to slip between languages, and because I can't, like, language is so particular, like what works as funny in one language is not necessarily, especially like in comedy where there's so much wordplay, it's a completely different
but there's also cultural things too.
Like what's funny to like a guy from, you know, Rome is not necessarily going to be funny to a guy from Des Moines, kind of thing. And
like I know my parents and their friends and stuff, I think they would enjoy more physical comedy.
Yeah.
So stuff like that. It's just a cultural thing.
Oh yeah. And I mean, that's like, well, like just for laughs.
Yeah.
Gags or whatever they call it. Or even like my grandparents' generation, like Heather and I will joke all the time whenever we see something that looks like Benny Hill, kind of like it's totally like weirdly sexy slapstick about how her grandmother would have loved it.
Yeah.
It's just like that's the humor that they found coming out of that moment in time, is like tiny man with cotton balls on his chest chasing a busty woman. Comedy. But now it's just that doesn't, we have our own like jackasses and stuff like that. But I just find like that intersection of language and culture so incredible, and when people can just jump between the two, it's just so impressive, so bananas. Now you held off on telling your parents that you were working in comedy for a while.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, you made the jump. You did stop your day job. When was the cue for you? Like, when did you feel like, oh, this is, I mean, aside from, because I know you talk about it on your web series about finding like that, you set aside a nest egg and
yeah.
you planned out investments and stuff like that. But from a creative point of view, what was your like trigger of, oh, this is when I need to do this?
Creatively, like I wanted to do it almost right away. It was just a matter of the financial responsibility of making the switch. And I knew that, you know, comedy doesn't pay well at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it wasn't a matter of like, creative. It was a matter of like, do I have the money to make the jump?
Mm-hmm.
And it took me 3 years of kind of like living frugally and saving up and having that nest egg to kind of wean off on as I'm doing comedy full time.
Mm-hmm. Now you talk a lot about merch,
yeah.
as a way to generate revenue as a comedian. Is that a core component? Because I think you were saying you'd make almost, in some shows, you'll make almost as much, if not more, than you do at the door.
A lot of Canadian comedians don't do merch, and I don't understand why. I feel like they feel like it's begging or beneath them or something. But it helps so much. You do have to do a show that's big enough to make it worth bringing up merch.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you kind of look like a fool if you're performing to six people and you're like, I'm selling merch after.
Yeah.
You're like, and then everyone just walks by you, six people. So, and then there's also like a certain amount of time you should be doing. Like if I just drop in and do a 5-6 minute set, I feel like I haven't built that rapport with people yet for them to know that, that an album would be worth it for them to buy.
Mm-hmm.
So once I do a show where I do a decent amount of time, over 10-minute set, and the audience size is a decent amount, then I'll pitch the merch. But yeah, I have a whole line of stuff now.
Oh, cool!
It started with buttons and one button, and then more, and I have like 6-7 different to choose from, and then I switched to greeting cards.
Cool.
I could just like kind of write funny things, mm-hmm. like, and that could be universal. They could use it for different holidays. And then now I have my album out, so I have like three different things to sell.
Yeah, because it is interesting because I don't know of many Canadian comedians who do it, but I mean I saw Ali Wong and she made a point of saying her husband would be out selling the merch.
Yeah,
like, and made him work the merch table.
That's the thing. I don't think a lot of the really big comedians, they won't work the merch table, because if they do, people are gonna talk their heads off.
Yeah.
So the line will get clogged and then they can't sell any. So they always get a neutral person. Like Ronnie Cheng hired me to sell his merch for him.
Oh wow.
At JFL 42. Yeah.
Well, it was the other one is Harry Condabloo. I saw him.
Yeah, he sells.
Yeah, and that was great because I got to like he signed my copy of his album.
Yeah,
and
he's very serious about merch. He'll like run after, like I opened for him at JFL 42, mm-hmm. and I saw him backstage. Like once he says thank you everyone, he goes to the back. Like I was just sitting in the dressing room waiting. He comes, he literally ran and grabs the merch, and then he's like, we'll talk later. And then he like goes to the front because he doesn't want to miss anyone.
And he's like really generous with his time too.
Yeah.
Like, and that's something I like, that's really nice, you know, because like a lot of comedians are like, oh yeah.
So you bought merch and you talked to him?
Merch and I talked to him and got him.
You were at a clogger, line clogger.
Well, for a couple of seconds, I was like, hey, big fan.
Yeah.
I really love your,
Matthew.
I saw his, the Apu special that he did, and I was like, that was an amazing special, thanks, like, because I do recognize, like, I don't want to be that guy who's like stick clogging up the line. I always feel awkward about that too. I still remember when I was in the university, first year university, I went to Ryerson and Tori Amos, because I'm like one of those like proto emo goth kids.
Nice.
I'm like, oh, Tori Amos is coming, and she was playing Massey Hall.
Yeah.
So I lurked backstage with about 20 other fans before she got there. So we lined up at like 3 in the afternoon because like, well, it's university, fuck class. I'm going to line up to like, and I just gave her my grandfather was a classical composer, and I gave her a copy of his music.
Yeah.
And she was like, "Oh, do you want an autograph?" I'm like, no, I just wanted to pass that along. Thank you. And she's like, "Oh my God." I was like, everybody was jealous. She gave me like this big hug, and that was totally not what I was going for. And I felt really awkward, but it's like, yeah, I do. I'm like, I don't want to be that guy who makes it so the other person behind me doesn't get an equal amount of time. But yeah, I mean, he Hari is just a nice person who is willing to spend time with his fans. And it's nice to have, and that's something I find comedians are more willing to do in a lot of ways. Like, they're like a musician, like they disappear kind of thing. But
I'm very surprised about it, actually. Like, so many times a big-ish name headliner will be like, "Oh, I'm just gonna, if you guys want to have a chat, I'm just hanging out, having a drink later, come say hi," or something. You don't hear that often, like to say hi to the, like, the lead singer or something.
And I think it's like, it's because I think comedy is all about these connections. It's about so you have people who are like, I want to make a connection with people. So they're more prone or willing to spend some time and talk with people. It's funny.
I'm also sure it's probably because a lot of them want to get laid too. the lead singer of a rock band has no problems with that. Where the headliner of some show is like, "Oh man, I need to get laid tonight. I'm having a drink. Come say hi." Especially if you're good looking.
But you know, it's like, Jim Jefferies used to have a lot of bits about like crazy sex escapades that he would get up to, and I'm like, this is just sounding a little bit desperate. Like. The guys that I knew who talked a lot of like this about sex did not actually have all this sex. It's like, I'm getting it. Oh, yeah.
He's trying to show off his value or like peacocking.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And he's still funny as hell, but it's just like, I'm a little bit skeptical right now. So are there any specials or albums that you find like really speak to you or maybe informed your comedy voice?
I liked Ali Wong's special. I like Aziz generally. So I'd say those two.
You probably did see the special he did after the sort of controversy.
Aziz? Watched it.
I thought it was like, I thought that was really powerful in that it was like, it addressed things head on and it took
he
ownership.
Talks about things.
He talks about it. And it's like, people are like, "Oh, there's no patent." I'm like, yes, there is. Look at Aziz. Like, it's not the scale of some of the other horrible people who came out at the same time. But it's like, it's declaring ownership over things and being honest and not abdicating. And it was, I don't want to say endearing, but it was like, it was refreshing to see somebody talk about, how they fucked up and how they're sorry and then say, and this isn't about me, this is about them. And respect the person that I hurt.
If I ever did anything similar to him, I would, that's how I would want to handle it in my stand-up.
And it's like I hate to even say the name, but Louis C.K. being so in the news now with his like it was 9 months before he started like, "I'm gonna take a step back and reflect." It's like, that's less time between, like, it's not even the time you take in a break between the seasons of your TV show. You already are back on the circuit. And it's like,
And then I think his first setback, there was a leak of it, and he totally dissed Asian guys about our dicks somehow. Like,
it was low hanging.
It was very low hanging fruit.
And it's like,
genitalia.
It's like hack material. Where it's just like, what is he doing? And it was, and I don't know. One of the reasons I love the Comedy Cellar every time I go to New York, but I kind of don't think I can go back there just for the fear of, because he shows up there at random, and I don't want to be in the audience with him there.
You wouldn't feel comfortable.
I wouldn't feel comfortable. It's one of those things where it's like, I really respected that guy's work for a long time.
Totally.
And then like,
because he gets the science of it. So.
I mean, if anybody, he's one of those people who's like totally understands the process. And he's able to take material that has no right being funny and makes it resonate in such a way where it's revelatory in a lot of ways. It's like, it's like Archie Bunker. He was doing a stand-up Archie Bunker kind of thing. And yeah, so it's like, I don't want to be in the comedy cellar, arms crossed, like, or, and I don't even want to be the guy who's walking out. So I'm just like, oh, there's Caroline's or something else in New York I can go to, or I'll go to one of the like little indie places in Brooklyn or something like that and support like smaller comedians. But
yeah,
it's just, it's weird because it's like I can't imagine like having, I don't know, having to live in constant fear of like those other women, those women who are professionals, like, is he going to be on the bill with me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, or even like that, like Harvey Weinstein situation. So this is a
he
weird
showed
tangent.
Up at a, he showed yeah, up at a comedy
comedy show. And then the comedy show and then harassed and his security harassed people who were calling him out on it. And it's like, fuck, it's like just such a, it's like, I don't know, like being at the tier that I am, I'm like, I just meet nice people. And so it's like, I can't understand how toxic some people can be in comedy.
Yeah. People with less morals often can get to the top easier. So there's more of them up top too, because they don't care about stepping on other people or doing things to other people.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So sorry, that was a very strange tangent to go down. But yeah, no, Aziz, I loved his his latest special, just because it was honest. And there's ownership too. Like, as a bigger guy, some of the stuff he said about his nephew was like, ouch. And he's like, man, I said a lot of fucked up shit. I am truly sorry for her. Yeah. And it did lasting damage to people I love. And which is something that not many comedians acknowledge in their material.
I think really good comedians are good at being self-aware. So that he's able to recognize things that he did helps him be better.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing where he goes from there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Ali Wong is just fucking astounding. I've seen her twice when she played. And I saw her at JFL 42 the night after she recorded her special. So there was a sign because they might have been doing pickups or something from the stage or something like that for the special. Like, you might be on this. But
so she was pregnant.
So yeah, so that was when she was pregnant. And then I saw the second time when she came back and she was pregnant again.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, is this a bit or is she actually pregnant? No, she was really pregnant a second time.
You thought she might pull out a pillow or something?
Exactly. Kidding. I just didn't know she didn't address it in at all, which is like, which is even better because if she was like off the top or even waited to the end, but she just left that like, was that a bit? I don't know.
Kind of if she ever gets accidentally or on purpose pregnant again, she'll for sure release another album. Right? She just has to it by this point.
Yeah, and she, like I first saw her on At Midnight. It's always a weird because they write for the comedian and they've got comedy writers all, like on staff who are stand-ups. So it's like it's not really their voice, but it is because they contribute and they sort of like, it's a lot more scripted than it seems. But from the get-go, I was like, she's just charming.
Yeah.
In a really hyper-aggressive way. But it's like, it's a charming hyper-aggressive, just like this intense energy.
Very expressive.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's very honest. Yeah. Like when she makes a joke, it's just like, it's what she thinks and you're either along for the ride or
the filter is off and she's also very entertaining.
Yes. Yeah.
So,
like, and there's some like going back to like an open mic that I went to, there's some people who like filter is off and
but
just
they're
like,
not entertaining.
That's not funny. Just because you're like being crass up there.
Yeah. Like her natural self is funny. She took off the filter. You don't want to see some people's natural self when they take off that filter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But so, hers you do.
Yeah. She's just a joy to watch. So, one last question.
Yeah,
it's an important one. What animal would your comedy be?
Oh wow. That's a hard one. I did stand up as an animal before.
Okay.
There was this comic in the scene called Dan Curtis Thompson. Do you know who that is? Yeah, he does. His show's called it's not running anymore, but I don't know what the name of it, but the idea behind it was that you had to embody an animal and then do your comedy in it. And I picked The Turtle.
Okay.
I feel like I'm very similar in that I like to hide in my shell when things get scary. I'm also very slow and kind of like steady. But I don't know if my stand-up is like a turtle. Because that's the question, right? Not like,
yeah, so
who am I as a person or a comedian? Who am I as a comedian? But who is my comedy as an animal? It's maybe an owl.
Okay.
Thoughtful.
Yeah, very
and
wise.
To be wise. Yeah. But a dirty owl. That's willing to...
Like a barn owl, not like one of those great horned owls or something.
It's not so majestic. It'll maybe sleep around with some other owls and stuff like that too. It's a seedy owl.
Yeah. Perfect. So if people wanted to find you, where could they
like to see me perform? You mean
see you perform, or like, find you online?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It'll probably be too late when this gets put out. But I'm at Absolute All This Week hosting. But you'll find me at Absolute Comedy a bunch of times. I'll do sets there a lot. Comedy bars. Pretty big hangout, but I also do a lot of shows at the John Candy Box Center at Second City. Online, like you said, you talked about, I have two YouTube series. If you're interested in comedy, like I do deep dives into the science behind it and also like the life of a stand-up. There's a lot of videos of me just floating around YouTube and Facebook. One video went viral, got 8 million views.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so
Do you get any YouTube money for that one?
It was on Facebook.
Oh,
so, yeah.
That's the bane of YouTube money is like everybody's like looking at things on Facebook now, so it doesn't get monetized.
It sucked. Yeah. And it was a CBC video. So if it did, they would get the money. But I did get a lot of fans through it. And then I tried to funnel that to my YouTube videos.
Yeah, that helps.
Yeah. But because of because it went viral, I started getting fans. And then that's why I was like, maybe I can try to funnel my Facebook fans into YouTube. And then I can make all these YouTube videos. And I said I'd go at it for a year. And if it didn't take off, because it was taking, a bunch of time to produce it and edit and all that, then I wouldn't continue with it anymore. And it didn't kill. So I was like, I'm going to focus on like stand up and trying to get into writer's rooms and stuff like that.
Yeah. Awesome. All right. Well, thanks very much.
This is awesome.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.